The Israeli defense minister is in Washington.
I think he's mostly there to talk about the growing tensions between Israel and Hezbollah in the north and to try to get American support.
Plus, synagogues and churches attacked in southern Russia.
Today has become a day of tragedy for Dagestan, and not only for Dagestan, but for our entire country. Unprecedented in their cruelty, terrorist attacks were committed today against religious sites in the capital of Dagestan, Makhachkala, and our ancient city of Durban.
And later, an update from Kyiv, and Kenyan troops are preparing to go to Haiti. Today is Monday, June 24th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, is in Washington for talks on the ongoing war with Hamas in Gaza. Meanwhile, international aid groups scramble to find survivors of recent Israeli attacks. They describe the scale of the damage as unprecedented. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
Sunday in Gaza City. Witnesses say at least 8 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike outside an aid center run by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. It was just one such mass fatality event in recent days near a humanitarian aid facility in the besieged Palestinian territories. At least 25 people were reported killed in a bombing near a Red Cross field hospital in Rafah. Head of the International Committee of the Red Cross Rafah Office, William Schomburg, on an agency feed as provided by the Associated Press.
The scale of this shock was quite unprecedented, at least for us. And to give you one very unfortunate but graphic detail, we literally found body parts scattered in different areas, including within the compound, which we then later collected.
The Israel Defense Forces released video claiming to show strikes on Hamas military structures in the Gaza Strip at around the same time. VOA cannot independently verify this or any other IDF content. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says more than 37,000 Palestinians have died in this conflict, which began October 7th of last year. It was then that the Western-identified terror group Hamas and its allies stormed into Israel, killing 1,200 and kidnapping some 250 others. Israel vowed the eradication of Hamas at all costs. But the scope of civilian casualties and widespread destruction of Palestinian territories gave even Israel's staunchest allies pause and led to the United States suspending a weapons shipment of bombs over fears of Israel dropping them in densely populated civilian areas. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last week released a video publicly accusing the White House of withholding weapons and ammunition from Israel. At a cabinet meeting over the weekend, he told officials that the basic state of affairs did not change with the U.S., adding that weapons shipments have slowed to a trickle. The White House says Netanyahu's comments came as a shock. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby at a White House briefing as provided by AP.
Those comments were deeply disappointing and certainly vexing to us, given the amount of support that we have and will continue to provide Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Following a week in which Netanyahu disbanded his war cabinet, Israelis again turned out for their weekly protest of Netanyahu's government, calling for his removal and the return of hostages still held by Hamas. Meanwhile, Israel continues operations in bordering Lebanon, targeting a member of the Hamas-allied Islamic group. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said the IDF is ready for any further action in Gaza, Lebanon, and unspecified additional places. Gallant left Sunday for meetings in Washington. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The families of hostages taken from Israel on October 7th have released a new video showing the moments their loved ones were taken. And as Arash mentioned, Yoav Gallant is in Washington. For a closer look, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
He says that his goal is to sort of talk to the U.S. about how Israel is going to transition from, a full-scale war in Gaza. Now the main parts of the fighting have apparently finished, although no one's exactly sure what that means. And I think he's mostly there to talk about the growing tensions between Israel and Hezbollah in the north and to try to get American support if Israel decides to kind of push this to an all-out war, which is where it does kind of seem to be heading.
Now, Gallant and Netanyahu aren't necessarily the best of friends. Is it really in Netanyahu's best interest to send Gallant here for that sort of mission?
Well, so that's a good question. I mean, one of the issues is, Netanyahu has been complaining that the U.S. has held up weapon shipments to Israel. The U.S. officials have said we actually have no idea what he's talking about. So it's been this kind of very public spat. Now, if, Gallant discusses these issues and if the U.S. comes out with a statement saying, we are going to return to the previous situation and fast track these things, that could make Netanyahu kind of look bad because he wasn't able to do this. He's complaining about it. And now Gallant goes and gets it. So, it's really not clear. But Gallant was invited by the defense minister, Lloyd Austin, the American, defense minister. So it's going to focus on kind of military things. And Netanyahu himself is going to the U.S. July 24th to address a joint session of Congress, which itself is causing all kinds of issues, as a significant chunk of the Democratic Party now says they're going to boycott his speech.
I want to get back to something you mentioned earlier, and that's the tension with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah, like Hamas, is funded and backed by the Iranian government. Is there any diplomacy efforts, any discussions with the Iranians coming from Israel to quiet things down?
As far as I know, there are no direct or indirect contacts with Iran. In April, for the first time, Iran attacked Israel directly with several hundred missiles after Israel assassinated a senior Iranian official in Syria. That said, it hasn't gone past that one sort of exchange of fire, and Iran has preferred to use its proxies. Hezbollah has so far not crossed the line, and Israel has so far not crossed the line that would lead to an all-out war. So you've got Israeli strikes killing senior Hezbollah officials in Lebanon, and that continues to go on. When someone senior is killed, Hezbollah responds with attack drones and other kinds of things. That said, it's pretty clear that Lebanon does not want a war with Israel. Israel has said that it would see all of Lebanese infrastructure as a possible target. At the same time, Hezbollah released this drone video, which we talked about last week, in which they showed, Israeli military targets near the port of Haifa. In other words, sort of a warning to Israel that they know what's going on. So I think the tensions with Hezbollah are tied to what's going on in Gaza. If there was a ceasefire in Gaza, it's possible that there would probably be a ceasefire in Lebanon as well. I think that, the Israeli public and the Israeli army doesn't really want a full-scale war with Hezbollah. Hezbollah has 150,000 rockets. The army is tired from almost 9 months of fighting in Gaza. The public is tired. And I think people just kind of want this war in Gaza to end. And then that would hopefully lead to a ceasefire with Israel and Lebanon as well.
Now, Linda, also making news in Israel today is a video released by the Hostage Families Forum. Can you tell us what that video shows and why it's important and what effect it will have on this?
Yes. So the video shows three young men who were at the Nova Music Festival, and they were kidnapped and are believed to still be alive and hostage in Gaza, one of whom I've spoken about before is the son of my friends Rachel and John Poland. And so it shows these three people being kidnapped, and the video is based on the Hamas terrorist cameras. And I think the idea is to kind of, I think maybe shock people a little bit and to remind people that, you know, it's 262 days. The Families Forum, in a statement, they said, the harrowing footage stands as a damning testament to the 262-day-long abandonment of our loved ones. They said that these three young men were taken alive and they must return alive today, and that every day that passes puts the hostages at greater risk and lessens the chances of bringing them back safely. So the Hostage Family Forum says there is a deal on the table. This is the deal that President Biden's been talking about, that Israel apparently accepted. And it seems that Netanyahu now may be backing away from it when he said in an interview that he would accept a temporary pause to get some of the hostages back, but the fighting won't end until Israel destroys Hamas. So I think it's kind of, it's a response to these comments, and it's an appeal to the Israeli public, the Israeli government, the American government, not to forget about the hostages.
VOA's Linda Gradstein reporting from Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
From war in the Holy Land to religious hatred around the world, an Australian lawmaker was the target of an anti-Semitic attack. But first, over 20 people were killed in Dagestan in the southern Russia Caucasus, where churches and synagogues were attacked. Reuters' Lauren Anthony reports.
A day after a series of brazen attacks on places of worship in Russia's Dagestan, a synagogue continues to smoulder. The mostly Muslim region announced 3 days of mourning on Monday after gunmen went on a rampage there in coordinated assaults on two of the republic's most important cities. The death toll has risen to at least 20. Here's Sergei Melikov, the governor of the Dagestan region.
Today has become a day of tragedy for Dagestan, and not only for Dagestan, but for our entire country. Unprecedented in their cruelty, terrorist attacks were committed today against religious sites in the capital of Dagestan, Makhachkala, and our ancient city of Derbent.
Melikov added that authorities understand who is behind the organization of the attacks, adding that foreign forces had been involved in preparing the assault. He did not give details, and there has been no immediate claim of responsibility. Attackers with automatic weapons burst into an Orthodox church and a synagogue in the ancient city of Derbent on Sunday evening. They set fire to an icon at the church and killed 66-year-old Orthodox priest Nikolai Kotelnikov. In the Caspian city of Makhachkala, around 75 miles north, attackers shot at a traffic police post and attacked a church. Gun battles erupted around the Assumption Cathedral in Makhachkala, with heavy automatic gunfire ringing out late into the night. At least five of the attackers were killed, and Russia's investigative committee said the majority of those dead were policemen. Dagestan is made up of a patchwork of ethnic groups, languages and regions that live in the shadow of the Caucasus Mountains between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea. President Vladimir Putin, who has long accused the West of trying to stoke separatism in the area, expressed condolences to those who lost relatives via his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. The attack on Christian and Jewish places of worship has stoked fears Russia may be facing a renewed militant Islamist threat just 3 months after a deadly attack in Moscow. 145 people were killed at the Crocus Concert Hall in March. Islamic State claimed responsibility for that attack.
That was Lauren Anthony of Reuters reporting. Meanwhile, in Australia, state and federal police are investigating an attack by a masked gang on the Melbourne office of a Jewish Australian lawmaker. Windows were smashed and fires were lit, and the slogan "Zionism is fascism" was painted in red over a picture of the face of Josh Burns, a member of Australia's House of Representatives. Phil Mercer has the story from Sydney.
Investigators in the state of Victoria believe a group of at least five people broke windows, spray-painted anti-Semitic slogans, and threw red paint into the office of Josh Burns, a Jewish member of the Australian House of Representatives. Police have confirmed the masked group also started two small fires. No arrests have yet been made. A chorus of politicians and community groups has condemned the vandalism. The Anti-Defamation Commission, a Jewish campaign group, said it was an assault on our democracy and our sense of safety. Burns said the assault on his office was premeditated, reckless, and dangerous. and that he'd been targeted in the past by vandals defacing his election posters. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the abuse has been escalating.
Since the war in the Middle East began on October 7, you know, my staff have been at the receiving end of some pretty horrendous comments and abuse on the phones. You know, I really don't want to see an escalation in political violence in Australia. We don't want a conflict on the other side of the world to be arriving here on our communities and our streets and in our neighbourhoods. We want to remain the wonderful and peaceful multicultural Australia where people are respected and free to live about their lives in the Australian way.
Australia has said Israel has the right to defend itself after the October 7 attack by Hamas militants. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ukraine's major cities, including the capital, Kyiv, suffered through a string of Russian missile strikes over the weekend and into Monday. The attacks led to multiple deaths and injuries, along with infrastructure damage, leaving many without electricity. Again, VOA's Lori London gets an update from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
So it was quite a tough weekend for Ukraine, and particularly the city of Kyiv and Kyiv region and the city of Kharkiv. These two regions were under pretty bad Russian attacks with the use of ballistic missiles. The Kyiv region was attacked with three missiles. However, there are no details of what facility was hit, but according to what we're hearing here, that a certain military facility was under attack. The city of Kharkiv suffered even worse attack. There were two attacks over the weekend. The first attack of the city of Kharkiv caused at least 56 people injured and at least two people killed. At least this is the latest information that we have at this point.
What kind of damage was incurred in Kharkiv over the weekend? Were there any specific targets?
Mainly Russian forces targeted the residential areas in the city of Kharkiv. The first attack caused quite a severe damage and some of the civil infrastructure across the city. The second attack caused, unfortunately, the damage of one of the medical institutions as well as also residential area.
And apparently the attacks didn't stop over the weekend. They've been continuing into Monday.
Yes, you're absolutely right. On Monday, the city of Odessa was under attack. And at this point, what we know is that the main target was one of the storage facilities in the city of Odessa.
Such a difficult situation across Ukraine. I understand the first EU portion of frozen Russian assets are expected to be arriving on Monday. What can you tell us about that? Is it in the form of weapons or finances?
As we already discussed, EU recently approved the transfer of Russian frozen assets to Ukraine for Ukrainian aid. And just on Monday, Ukraine is expecting to receive the first tranche from the EU. And this tranche would be in the amount of up to 1.4 billion euros from the frozen Russian assets. And this money, according to the preliminary information, will be used to purchase of ammunition and air defense systems for Ukraine, as well as to buy certain ammunition directly from the Ukrainian industry companies.
Anna Chernikova reporting for us from Kyiv. Thank you, as always, so much.
Thank you, Laurie.
After multiple delays and court challenges, it appears that the deployment of Kenyan police officers to Haiti may be set for Tuesday. This comes after Kenya's high court ruled earlier this year that such a deployment was unconstitutional. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, Miriam Diallo, has the story.
Multiple inquiries to the government of Kenya for confirmation of such reports were not answered. This development comes after many delays and court challenges, including the newest lawsuit that accused Kenyan President William Ruto of contempt of court. Last year, a United Nations Security Council resolution approved the Kenyan-led mission, but earlier this year, the High Court of Kenya ruled against the deployment, saying it was unconstitutional. Issues cited by the court include the lack of a reciprocal agreement between the countries. The Kenyan government eventually secured that agreement, but the same people who sued the government in the first place filed another lawsuit seeking to block the deployment. Wallace Nderu is a lawyer and a program officer at ICJ Kenya, the International Commission of Jurists, a non-governmental, non-profit, member-based organization. From a legal perspective, he tells VOA, the legitimacy of the agreement is still in question.
The grounds for this application is that one, when the then Prime Minister of Haiti was signing this agreement with Kenya, there was no known government in Haiti. The president had been assassinated. There was no elected leaders in Haiti. So where he derived the mandate to be able to execute the agreement on behalf of his country, Haiti, comes into question.
Nderu also says Kenyans feel that this agreement was hastily put together, noting its content has not been shared with the population.
Part of the provisions in the law, and especially Section 107 of that particular act I mentioned, being the National Police Service Act, indicates that this agreement, after its signing, has to be gazetted in the official Kenya Gazette. So a concern is raised. This particular agreement is very secretive. We're not aware of the contents of this particular agreement. It raises the legitimacy of the government deploying the police to Haiti.
A new commander for the police force was appointed on Monday by the Inspector General. President Ruto has always maintained that stabilizing the troubled Caribbean nation is, quote, a mission for humanity, a mission for solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Haiti, unquote. In addition to Kenya, other nations, including Benin, the Bahamas, Bangladesh, Barbados, and Chad, said they will join the mission as well. While some Kenyans support the mission in Haiti, others have wondered why their country wants to lead the multinational force, given that nations more powerful and better equipped have not been willing to step forward. This reported deployment will be taking place on the same day that protests against proposed tax increases that have rocked Kenya in the past week are set to resume. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The death toll continues to rise in South Korea, where an explosion at a battery factory has already claimed the lives of 22 people. Sean Hogan of Reuters has more.
22 people have been confirmed dead after a large explosion set a lithium battery factory on fire in South Korea on Monday. The blaze started after a series of battery cells exploded inside a warehouse with some 35,000 units, a local fire official said. What had triggered the explosion remains unclear. The factory is run by battery manufacturer Aracel in Hwaseong, a major industrial cluster about 90 minutes southwest of the capital Seoul. A Reuters witness saw firefighters moving up to six bodies out of the factory. 18 Chinese workers and one Laotian were among the dead, local fire official Kim Jin-young told reporters, citing information from company officials. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the scene and was given a briefing by officials. Interior Minister Lee Sang-min called on local authorities to prevent any hazardous chemicals from contaminating the area. Kim Tae-ho, a fire and disaster prevention professor at Taejeon University, said battery materials like nickel are easily flammable, so the fire probably spread too quickly for workers to escape. Aracel makes lithium primary batteries for sensors and radio communication devices. Calls to its offices went unanswered. The company is not listed on South Korea's stock market, but is majority owned by S-Connect, according to regulatory filings. S-Connect is registered on the Junior KOSDAQ Index and its shares closed down 22.5%. South Korea is a major industrial economy and has made efforts to improve its safety record after several past accidents, many of which have been blamed on negligence.
That's Reuters' Sean Hogan reporting. And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. issues in the news explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.